trafficking and would not be unlawful in prison.
Why is the, I mean, is the deceased any prevalence of conveying girls to prevent their marriage?
Well, there's not a lot of kids, but there are kids.
What do you think about that?
That's a good idea.
Your papa didn't like you up in the camp. And you were 14, I mean.
Yeah, right.
Granted, none of these situations are going to cause, I mean, there are not going to be numerous cases in this whole section, I think, as you can see. I mean, there aren't even that many kidnapping cases in volume of numbers in any of these particular situations. But up until this time, in going on further, like compelling an elderly person, confining to compel him to sign a will or a deed, or having the same person confined to an insane asylum, there are a number of cases in these areas. And up until now, there would be no criminal sanction against this. Your only remedy would be a remedy of damages under the civil law, which would be, quite inadequate in some of these circumstances.
Oh, in those cases you've read, who have been the defendants, the actor, or the prosecuting witness, or a public official? Some cases where public officials are receiving into lawsuits or criminal prosecutions for causing the same person to be?
No, the same person confined to an insane asylum, these have been particular people, like a father or wife or someone who has had a person confined to a private institution. The situation where public officials will come in will be in this unlawful imprisonment. In the cases of police who would make unlawful arrests, this would be with a warrant that they knew was defective on its face, or who unlawfully arrested a person and who knew that the arrest at the time they made it was unlawful, or that the warrant was defective, or that they should have had a warrant. If they do not know this, like said a warrant is defective for reasons that the police aren't supposed to know, then that is a defense and they don't come under this section. It would be only in the cases where the police are being abusive of their role and knowing who they are, so that they would come under this criminal sanction. And then I don't know what we're drafting as far as public officials being exempt from. That will come later in other sections.
That will be under some preliminary
situation. Mm-hmm. So that gets us into, then we've gone through the unlawful imprisonment in second degree and in first degree, and then we're in custodial interference. Now, this taking from custody, we define the age of 16, and taking from custody meaning a substantial interference with parental or custodial control. Now, this would not be the, a short, an hour taking a child to a movie type situation, a 16-year-old to a movie without the parent's consent. It isn't meant to include that type of thing. It is meant to be a substantial interference. And this, of course, then would be a matter of judicial interpretation.
Right, Don, how formal would the subcommittee meetings been? Been somewhat informal?
Very informal, yes.
Uh-huh.
Because this is where we do most of our thrashing out of these provisions and just generally discuss them from one end to the other, and from the standpoint of the policy considerations behind the drafts, as well as the structure of the drafts. We try to give everyone an opportunity to discuss all aspects of the drafts, so that we can, by the time the subcommittee has settled on a particular draft, that when it goes to the full commission,
Well, I'm very sorry Jim Redden isn't here, because he's has handled criminal cases, and they are generally pretty knowledgeable. Suppose we do this. He's not going to show. Why don't we send this to him and ask him to take off a half an hour or so and digest this?
Yeah.
See
what
it is.
He's already been sent a copy of this draft.
No, he has.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Why don't we do that? Ask him to get on the ball and drop things and get that out so that we can do it, because we can't take action. We won't have a quorum.
But you might want to, particularly with Dean here and Judge Sloan, you might want to talk about some of these generally.
Very good. Sure.
So that, I don't think there's any question there's going to be quite a difference of opinion, particularly with some sections of this draft. And so any comments that would be of help to Gene and to the staff with respect to any possible oversights that occur to you in this draft, or any recommendations for changes or amendments to it, even though we don't have a quorum, just a general discussion I think would be helpful to us.
All right, let's hear from them. How about you, Joyce?
Well, turning back to section one.
Pardon me. Have you had an opportunity to check this over before we can edit it?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Not carefully, I don't. The expression, except as the context of the other may require otherwise. Now, I don't know that has appeared in any of the other drafts that we've had.
Oh, yes, it
has.
Yes, and this was at the suggestion of legislative council's office.
Was it?
Yeah, and this is a standard pattern and format to use in the definition section, so that we don't tie ourselves down possibly have some other definition that might be appropriate, or the definition that's defined. I don't think this would be much of a problem.
Right.
Ordinarily, these definitions are going to control, but it's a standard drafting technique to leave yourself an out, I guess is what it's.
Well, I suppose leave the court an out.
Yeah, right.
It's what it's intended to do, I suppose, that you get into these. Well, things like we've been wrestling with a case the last two or three weeks or more, where there's a definition written into the statute that is just almost meaningless, and you're stuck with it. I suppose if it had an expression like this in it, well, maybe you could judicially make some kind of a definition that might have some kind of clarity to it, or attempt to anyway. Okay, then I have a question again about the use of the word substantial. And I realize you've got to use some kind of a word. And it's conceivable that I was wondering if the commentary as you have here, well, it appears over here later, I guess, in the letter.
Your feeling is the use of that word substantial would be rather difficult of enforcement, is that it?
Well, it's not necessarily. I agree with Gene that at least I would. Put in 10 hours, 12 hours, 1 hour would be difficult. And if in a commentary that could be attached or followed this, if maybe, as you mentioned when you were explaining this, that I noticed back here, for instance, the New York code uses 12 hours and so on. If you could say the codes from these other states have used a fixed number of hours and so forth, and it's the thought of this commission that you've developed, that confinement for an hour could be substantial.
Yeah, and this would give the courts an opportunity to look at the totality of the circumstances in any individual case.
Would that be a question of fact for the jury? Or
I think so. Like the question you put a little while ago of back here on the lesser offenses of restraining somebody.
For instance, take that word substantial. Wouldn't that be then become a question of fact?
I would think so. You mentioned the youngster, for instance, that might be held by the house detective at Sears and Roebuck or someplace.
Well, okay. I didn't mean to interrupt. I mean, we do have a shoplifting statute in Oregon now to cover house detectives.
But I was thinking not so much the,
okay.
The shoplifting, but the. Is the house detective violating this act if he takes a 16-year-old kid in?
Yeah, suppose shoplifting weren't in Brown.
No. Or he finds him in an office and says, "Now you stay here," and closes the door. And, is this a substantial deprivation of liberty?
Yeah.
And I suppose in a context like that, the word substantial would then have, would be a jury question. Was this a substantial depriving of this person of liberty?
How would the court, in its instructions, define substantial?
It could be anything. To some people, it would mean one thing to some another. There's no question about that.
Might be 3 minutes, might be 7 hours.
Well, in most cases, don't you think that the court probably, in its instructions, wouldn't attempt to define substantial, would it?
I don't know. It's a hard word.
Well, I can come back to that. It isn't a matter of arrest. I don't mean in the sense of serving a warrant or calling the person in the station. I mean that kind, just to interfere with a person's movements. That's an arrest. They're only momentarily.
But under this definition, it's very unlikely that it would fall within any of these crimes that she set out in this draft. It's possible, I suppose, but if you just reached out and grabbed a person, of course, that kind of case would even be a very close question under a false imprisonment or false arrest, I would think. And I think this criminal definition here would be much more restrictive.
Didn't arrest one of the definitions to interfere with a person's movement?
Well, I think you'd have to take arrest, at least in the context of seizing a person for the assumed violation of some criminal act, which would be different than...
But it isn't confined to that, is it?
Well, I think you'd have to distinguish between restraint and arrest. Perhaps.
Now you're thinking, about a civil tort case, say for false arrest, and what amounts to an arrest.
I think a case in law school was Andrew's company to get off a car, a public transportation. The conductor said, "It's a minute, chum, you're not getting off here. You didn't pay your fare." That was held to be unlawful arrest. Put his hand on him and stopped him just for early.
Yeah. Well, of course, none of these definitions are intended to affect the tort law.
I know. Well, then, is that word substantially, what are we going to do with it?
Well, I think in some of these definitions, and as you read the commentary of the Model Penal Code throughout their earlier drafts and all these sections, when they get to certain definitions, they realize you can define something just so far, and then it ceases to be effective. And
I understand. Well, then it isn't agreed by everybody that that's going to remain.
Well, one can be changed. Maybe the thing is, if we agree on a policy of what we want, I mean, how much of a restraint do we want, and where do we want to draw the line? Do you want any little confinement to be an unlawful imprisonment, or do you want to put in some differentiating thing, making it substantial or more serious? My feeling was that it had to be something beyond a minor confinement, because we didn't want to include that. And that was the commentary in the Model Penal Code. Their reason for using substantially interfering with his liberty was, to me, to connote the idea of something that was serious, that was something of, not just a small detention, but was a substantial, something that should be a criminal sentence, that should be punished by a criminal penalty. And so the thing would be is maybe if we decide a policy of where you think the line should be drawn, then the word would have to follow more or less. I don't know if that doesn't help or not.
Oh, I would agree with what Justice Sloan said, that I think this is a better way of doing it than, say, New York does it, where arbitrarily say X a number of hours.
So do I. You can't tie this down to a matter of this kind of minutes or hours, because for a reason you can point it out.
And So if you're not going to tie it down...
Somebody can beat the clock by 2 minutes.
You've got to have some discretion available to the authorities who are going to be administering these laws.
All right. Now then, Judge, what is your next comment?
Over in Section 3, and I realize this is language that appears in the penal code, but I'm going to confess I do not understand what it means. And that is...
what do you say there?
Well, first I see what...
Well, now, excuse me, but the particular language is a person commits a crime of kidnapping if he unlawfully removes another from his place of residence or business, and then this is the language, or a substantial distance from the vicinity where he is found. What does that mean?
Yeah, what they wanted to do there, or a substantial distance from the vicinity where he is found. The reason for this was to avoid the robbery rate
situation. You mean from the place in which he's taken?
He's first seized at the point where you, the defendant, would first have contact with the victim. Now, this would be like in a robbery situation, like say it was a bank robbery, at the point at which the robber would have caught the cashier or something.
Where he's not eventually located after sucker, but where he's found in the first instance, by the criminal.
And it's kind of vague wording, but the idea was if they wanted, they didn't want to pinpoint it, they didn't want to say area, they wanted it to be just a removal from where he first was. And since you don't know where he first is, it's pretty hard to define it.
Well, you mean where he was found
by the defendant. See, this would be, there's like People versus Duggar, I put into the rape situation where the victim was moved 22 feet in the course of the crime. Well, they don't want to make this a kidnapping situation. Or in the bank robbery case where the cashier is moved from the front of the bank to the back and confined in a vault, say. You know, that very small displacement incidental to another offense, you don't want to come under kidnapping. And this was their feeling for putting in the substantial distance. And they kicked around the wording quite a bit. From the vicinity where it's found, they had area before. And then they changed it to vicinity.
Well, I wonder why they want to limit this to residence or place of business. Like it could be on the street, or schoolyard, any kind of a place.
Well, wouldn't that be the vicinity where found?
Well, vicinity where found would cover the situation when you're not at your residence. Residence or business would be the particular type of kidnapping cases where you would remove a child from his home or a person, you know, from their business. Where you would actually take the person in their regular haunts, like their house or their home, and remove them from there. Or if to make sure that you cover the situation where he isn't in either of those places, then the substantial distance from the vicinity where he would be found.
Suppose he's found. Suppose he's forced to find a go over to Lloyd Shopping Center, around the corner, and sit in a car. That would still be in the vicinity, wouldn't it? The victim would still be in the vicinity.
Now, you mean he's walked from the Lloyd Center to his car?
He's removed from his place of residence for a substantial distance. Substantial. It says substantial distance comes into play.
Comes into play, and then it's a matter of the jury again. Has he been removed? Because in some cases, I could see where a jury might think that, you know, removal of a block might be a substantial issue, depending on where you are and what the situation is. Whereas in some places, it might take miles.
But the...
considered a...
it seems to me that the use of the pronoun he in there is pretty ambiguous, isn't it?
Very.
Well, we're not sure whether we're talking when we say where he is found. It isn't clear when you read it whether you're talking about he meaning the victim or he meaning the defendant. And I think that is, wasn't that your point?
That's part of it. It was just kind of meaningless.
Yeah, could be.
In other words, the he could be defined or careful, like putting perpetrator or actor or a term that would designate the kidnapper.
Well, is that what we're trying to designate, or aren't we trying to designate the victim?
Well, the he.
Where he is found.
We're trying to designate the kidnapper.
Yeah.
Then from his place, we put in the
interrupt, as I started to say, but I was wondering if it would conceivably pay to put in the definitions the word victim and abductor, or something of that kind, and then you could say the person commits the crime of kidnapping if the abductor unlawfully removes the victim from any place where he finds him, where he finds the victim.
You mean leaving all the substantial distance from?
Right.
Yeah.
It would seem to me like distance is less important than you, as you mentioned a minute ago. You get in certain areas where the problem of finding someone, or the labyrinth of buildings, or whatever it may be, you can move him 15 feet, and he'd be just as unfindable if you take him 15 miles out in the country someplace. That if he removes him, to where he is secreted, or...
Well, see, that gets him then the next four. The unlawfully confined to a substantial period in a place of isolation. You have the same problem with the word isolation, because what constitutes isolation? You can be just as isolated, locked up in a bank vault, nobody knew you were there, as in a cabin in the woods.
Right.
So that, we've got the same problems with isolation.
Substantial period, and the word commencing the word in, and ending with the compound of isolation.
Oh, we don't want to delete, do we? I think we want to reword the whole section. Isn't that more the feeling?
Well, yeah, I think so. Is it just to clarify between the distinction between the abductor and the victim? Business or residence, couldn't you? I mean, if you're, wouldn't those fall within the substantial distance from the vicinity where he was found anyway? Wouldn't those fall within that?
I would think they would. I think the only reason they put those in is because to retain, like I said, the basic nature of kidnapping for ransom, having been removal of like a child from his home. And I think that wording was kept simply to make sure that was, you know, very pointedly brought out this section was covering that. Because the thing to remember is this was taken from the Model Penal Code. The Model Penal Code only has one kidnapping section. So I think they were trying to be very careful that one offense was spelled out. And so we could probably delete it and keep the same meaning.
All right, and how would you suggest it?
In other words, they felt that taking from his place of residence or business would be more serious than abducting him someplace else.
No, it would be the same situation, but the thing that they wanted to really point out is if they wanted their section to cover the kidnapping for ransom situation, and they only tacked on the couple of other purposes, you know, as extras, but when they first drafted this, there was only going to be one section, kidnapping for ransom. And I think that this wording got retained because this was reworded about three times as the draft went on. The substantial is the vicinity area. This was reworded in the first round. And I think that was the reason they left it. I may be wrong.
How about the word, let me make a suggestion. How about using the word takes?
It takes in place of removes?
Takes has been defined.
What do you think about that, Gene?
Well, I think the only thing we're trying to get across. The only thing we're trying to get across is that you're removing him, I mean, that you're taking him from one place to another place. The element of movement is what we're trying to incorporate in there. For our way now, see, this is a judgment factor here, too.
Well, I wonder why you can't use the word abduct as you do in second degree. If that doesn't mean the same thing, if in first degree,
well,
if he abducts him with these intents, now in the second degree, you say he's guilty of the crime if he abducts the person. Well, then you look back and see what abduct means, which would be substantially the same thing as you say removing him from his place of residence or business or substantial distance, etc.
Except for the problem is that when you do that, you don't retain the substantial distance.
Well, but what difference does that make? I mean, these are, I would understand, are in a sense policy determinations, but they're also trying to relate the offense to what happens. Why would it be to take you from a substantial distance, make it any more of a heinous offense than if it only takes him 100 yards, but he does it for these particular purposes?
Good point.
Why isn't it just as much to abduct him in the desert for these purposes?
Or 50 feet.
Right. He's got the...
Took him one place to another, say, or to an office in that building.
Well, I think the only thing there we have to be careful of is that number B. To facilitate the commission of any felony or flight thereafter. The one thing that bothers the draftsman of the Model Penal Code and the draftsman of the New York Revised Code was the double offense, like kidnapping, kidnapping robbery. Be careful that you don't.
The genie, but regardless of the objective, whether or not it comes under A, B, or C, the matter of the primary is with control. There ought to be a complete defense to say it only took him, didn't take him a substantial distance. It took him, say, 50 feet.
No, I don't understand why that would be a defense.
Beg your pardon?
How could just taking him 50 feet be the
case? Well, I'll tell you how you could. It's possibly far-fetched in a secret manner. Let's say take someone from one room to an unused room in the building. Could be done.
And lock him up.
Yeah. In isolation.
As you said, in a bank vault or any other kind of a vault.
Could
he? Could just.
I guess what I'm worried about is what happens in. Maybe this is covered. Maybe I don't see it. But would this then cover the situation like in a robbery case where where you took the person, like, say, a few feet, would you be able, like, say, from the front of the bank to the back, you confined him there and held him, say, for 10 or 15 minutes while your friend in the front? Would this then, could this constitute both kidnapping and robbery?
You mean, for instance, like in a store?
That's
for instance, I was stuck up in a store one time. I'll never forget it. I'd be tough on any guy using a gun. Shoved a gun on me in a market. I went into the shop and took me back about 30 feet and back there, and three other victims were in the facility there. Well, I wasn't moved a substantial distance. Of course, there was a crime of robbery there. I was. Well, that hardly could have called kidnapping.
No, but it's been prosecuted in some states after.
Isn't this what New York gets at? We talk about a 12-hour period, isn't it? Kidnapping across the board with those accumulated felony situations.
But the point
your term. In other words, just taking him to the back of the store wouldn't be kidnapping unless you held him there for 12 hours, say, under the New York
Code. That's what they're trying to avoid.
The point the judge raised was whether that was about that word, substantial risk.
Well, you see, for instance, now you say in by definition the word abduct means to restrain a person. To restrain a person is to move him or hold him.
We said to interfere substantially with his liberty by moving him from one place to another, but we make no requirement that the movement be substantial.
Well, I don't think, as I say, to me.
You don't think that's important?
I don't think that'd be important. As if these people would have taken Senator Mahoney, as you say, and held you there for 5 or 6 hours, to me that would be a substantial confinement.
Well, see, what I'm worried about is we're writing out the word substantial by using just the word abduct, aren't we?
No, because abduct means to restrain.
Right, but see, restraint doesn't mean a substantial time or a substantial...
Well, if the substantial, the substantial interference with his liberty, isn't that more important than the distance he's moved?
That's right.
Oh, I see what you mean.
That's right.
You can move him 100 miles,
mm-hmm.
and maybe all you've got him is in an automobile with no threat of any force or anything. You've just said, come on, bud, I'm not going to get out here. You pick up a hitchhiker. I want you to drive me on to Eugene, or I'll hit you, or I'll do something. So you drive him on to Eugene, and he gets out of the car, and that's the end of it. Well, that's a different thing than if he puts a gun on me and drives me off in the woods someplace where I can't be found. Doesn't mean there's how far I go, it's what he does to me.
Yeah, I think it's a good observation. I think that what should be a primary concern, we're talking about aggravating a crime and making it more serious, is what the intent of the defendant was when he committed this act. Did he intend, was he attempting to compel this person, say, under A, sub A, to pay ransom, you know? And if this was what he was intending to do, and he was attempting to force somebody else to pay ransom, the fact that he just took this, say he took the child just a short distance, should be immaterial.
Should be immaterial,
right? That's a good point.
And I think that, I go on with that wholeheartedly, and like I said, the only thing that had bothered me was the double offense situation. And that was one of the reasons I made it be optional, because I don't think it's necessary to put in. Because I think that just confuses the issue and may lead
to facilitate the commission of felony.
On your flight thereafter.
Yeah. And I
see the flight thereafter, the hostage, should be covered by the wording of A. That's broad enough to cover the hostage situation. So there should be no reason to include that. And see, I think if we delete that, then there's no reason to worry about
the
rape situation.
Jenny, where did you hear that word substantial? Did you find that in the
Model Penal Code? It's been substantial all the way through as meaning a more serious interference.
Okay, where did you find it? Model Code or some other version?
The Model Penal Code.
Yeah, that's where it's from. The Model Penal Code.
What are we going to do with that word, substantial?
Well, if I understand the tone of Justice Sloan's comments, then what we would have in first degree would be something to the effect that a person commits the crime of kidnapping in the first degree if he
abducts another person with
the intent to do these things for these purposes.
And then, if I understand, now, would everyone be in favor of deleting B?
Well, just so long as it was clearly understood that the hostage part was included in this to engage in conduct. Is that in the model penal code where they actually use the word hostage?
They actually use shield and hostage can be included in a, can actually be spelled out.
Whereas a shield or a hostage. I suppose, for instance, that very heavy prison riots, and they grab a guard and pull him for 2 or 3 days or whatever it would be, that would be a kidnapping. Mm-hmm. And would be a more glorified, serious offense.
Well, I'd get you in the first degree.
It's in the first degree, right?
No, A was intended to cover the shield and hostage. Very definitely. If the feeling is that it isn't spelled out clearly enough, we can't include the word.
But
seeing
him like shield or hostage, because you don't necessarily ask the hostage to engage in any conduct. In fact, all you do is, I suppose, put him someplace to hold.
Prison riot, you're not asking the judge to do something so much as you're asking the warden of the Board of Control of our state to give up or whatever it happens to be.
It would seem to me like it would pay to put in the word shield or hostage. Both for ransom reward or as a shield or hostage.
would, I have to see if we can split, would you want to delete then, or to engage in other particular conduct, or to refrain from engaging in particular conduct?
Not necessarily, no.
Or would you like to do that and include the or?
Include. I understand these are purely suggestions, I'm not.
No, I just wanted to make, see, I didn't know what I was thinking of was, you know, being repetitious, if we would need that other. Because originally I had thought it would be broader and would include more, could include more types of.
Well, you have, be both a hostage, either be a hostage and ask to do nothing, other than they're just holding you with the threat that if they don't do something, this man will be harmed. Or you can have the situation where you are saying to the guard, you get me out of here. And he forces the guard to take him out through the gate or whatever it may be, through the open door of the bank or what.
Yeah, because we have problems with the way that's worded to compel a third person. It covers the whole section.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't cover compelling the victim.
What do the commentators of the Model Penal Code say, if anything, about the distinction between their A and B under their section 212.1, their kidnapping? This to facilitate commission of any felony. Now, wouldn't that take in, for example, a rape where you had the defendant took the victim and committed a rape, and this was either to facilitate commission of the rape by getting her, getting the victim in an isolated place or something of that nature, or to prevent her from reporting it after the commission of the rape. Say. I'm just wondering if that's what they're, if that's what that's intended to do, or if this is a. It seems to me that could also include the shield or hostage situation, couldn't it?
Sure. In fact, there's an overlap between all of the ones they have now. Remember, we had deleted the interference with forms of governmental or political function, too, which we felt had overlap in the same session. But the thing on the counter, they don't spell out why. They included B, still take commission of any felony to fight thereafter. Now, some of the states they have don't have the thereafter, still take commission of any felony to fight. Now, that is because we certainly are asking, would want so they have commission of felony. Because that would be a problem, a real problem of interpretation. Because in all instances, removing a person would almost facilitate the commission of a crime.
Well, I'll gamble. Just from the experience in one of these other drafts, the word after, I don't remember if it was debated, I've forgotten on what context the debate was, but there was.
Or that was the robbery, wasn't it?
The robbery, where there was a word like this used.
I noticed it
was debated in some way, but not the word should be there.
Why
yeah. I think so. Right.
Well, we talked about
words. Right.
But D, we did not
know. D. Let's take it this way. State D, if you interfere with the performance of any governmental or political function. I know these things sort of fit in one to another, but let's say that I'm bringing an initiated petition down here to file it for the last day. Somebody stops my car and pulls me up to pass the dock of the town. That would come under D, would it? Under D in the model code.
It could, but
it would. But you do not.
No, because I don't think that should. I didn't feel I should be kidnapped. I'm very talented at kidnapping.
At least first degree
kidnapping. It could come under second degree, or it could come under unlawful imprisonment. But I don't know where you define it. But I'm assuming that kidnapping the first degree is going to carry the heaviest penalty.
Well, sure is. As a matter of fact, it was attempted some years ago. That's the king of the mine.
But would you want to give someone life imprisonment for that? Or for
well, it's a very serious matter. I'm not kidding.
Well, then that
would be. Did a run initiated going on the ballot?
We might put that in just to press the legislature.
It could be done.
Well, I think what they had in mind, what the commentary had in mind, interfere with the performance of government function, meant cases of assassination. Or cases of kidnapping to compel, like if you kidnapped President Johnson's daughter, to compel him to stop bombing in Vietnam. This was the type of situation. And this can would be covered again under A if you worded A properly. But these were the type of
to engage in other particular conduct,
right,
or refrain from
engaging. This was the type of thing that they had intended to cover.
Well, in other words, Tom, what she's saying is that she felt that the situation such as you gave in your hypothetical would be covered under A, and that she didn't think it was necessary to spell it out specifically with respect to a governmental
function.
That it would be...
I mean, separating the governmental officers as a separate class versus the citizens at large, unless you could see an instance where they wouldn't be covered under the general citizenry, why would we need to put in a separate clause to cover them? That type of thing. Unless, you know, it may be that we could think of a situation where they wouldn't be covered by the general wording, and then there might be a need for that. But I just don't think...
I'd be inclined to agree with it. Do you think that it ought to be separate as far as governmental would?
Well, I think it's part of it. It looks like as much a choice of penalty as to describing what it is. Would you say it would undoubtedly come within this initiative?
Well, right, like
wouldn't be compelling a third person to do anything because he would be the one carrying it. You're restraining him from doing it, not a third person, but it would come under abduct. So, it looks like the debate is not. What is it? What are you going to do to him for it? It's covered. You want to cover here or here?
Well, like the situation of Sudan, he's a candidate for political office in the last election. Just the fact that he's a political officer, should he come on with general offense of kidnapping in the second degree and be moved to the first degree because of his office? Now, if we think that there's a policy reason why he should be, because of the freedom of government and all the values that he put out there, then that's different. But if we don't, then I see no reason for making him any different than any other person.
Well, why couldn't you just strike the word third out of sub A?
Compelling person.
Yeah. And then that would cover that kind of situation.
Just strike the third person.
Yeah. What the purpose is it? It's restricted.
Yes, that would be a help. Tell any person.
I guess the reason I put that in is I was thinking of the fact that when you say compel any person, would that also include compelling the victim to pay?
Well, yeah,
then
would,
it
would sure.
Be versus almost ransom, wouldn't it? I mean, would that be...
Well, it's not extortion. It's not extortion. At least it wouldn't be under our extortion draft unless they got property as a result of it. So it wouldn't be covered under extortion. I mean, it, just to force them to do or refrain from doing a certain act would not amount to extortion under our theft draft because there's no property involved.
Would it amount
to
some
cases
to
Well, here again, it wouldn't be robbery if there was no property. I mean, in most instances, I would think, you know, when you think of a classic kidnapping case, it is to compel a third person, a parent or somebody, to pay ransom or to do a certain act. But in light of the hypothetical that was raised by Senator Mahoney about, a legislator or someone in the course of their duties or about to do something who himself is abducted,
maybe I can't see this, but if you just say compel a person, I mean, it could be you're compelling the victim to do things, not being a third party, then it's not really the typical kidnapping situation, is it? Because you're compelling his behavior isn't a kidnapping situation. Wouldn't that be more, more unlawful?
Kidnapping is an abduction, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically what we're talking about, and we're saying that it's more serious if he's abducted for any of these
purposes. Right.
Purposes.
Okay.
Well, I'm wondering again if it would pay to use the word victim or an abductor or actor or some other word, and then you could say to compel the victim or any other person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if it wouldn't simplify to have a word as a victim of abductor or whatever it may be that you're talking about. But in Denver's bill here, to specifying what else create the crime, to use those words so that it's clear who it is and who's acting that creates the situation that is either a more serious offense or less offense.
Need to define the terms, but
they may not need to, right?
Because actor, for example, I'm not sure, or victim, I think that's self-explanatory.
I would assume so.
In most instances, and I think you'd need to.
Yeah, it wouldn't have a problem with science definition. But I just meant it doesn't, you know, would read all through, like, first and second. And then you would compel a victim or any other third person to pay.
Well, I wouldn't put any third, I'd just put any other person. It is possible that on closer, more detailed analysis, but by referring strictly to the victim, for instance, it may be too confining, I don't know.
Probably wouldn't in this section. Just from the nature of kidnapping, there's going to be one or two, but the victim would almost be spelled out as the lieutenant commander.
Theft by extortion, identity graph number one, section four. Theft by extortion, a person commits theft by extortion when he compels or induces another person to deliver property. And we just use the terms, another person, in that, which would be broad enough and was intended to be broad enough to cover compelling any other person.
That might be easy to put that in to compel another person. It might still be another person other than the way this is put.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. if they aren't so near the same thing, that you have trouble. This question that comes up so repeatedly in our present code of a charge can refer to either one, and one would be a misdemeanor and the other a felony. See, serious bodily injury could be the same as endangered as health or safety.
Right, now serious bodily injury is another one of these terms that will be defined by the federal
in the
overall
definitions.
And what I had intended, now maybe I didn't make myself clear on this, because I can see what you mean, and it is my feeling was that unlawful prison, the risk of serious bodily injury would be much more, would be more serious, more severe type of offense than just simply risking of safety. In other words, this risk of safety would be maybe a health material compared to me. Something like where a sick child, like a child with influenza or pneumonia, is removed from his home. And that certainly would endanger his health. But at the same time, it may not be risk of serious bodily injury. Risk of serious bodily injury, I was thinking of instances where you actually place him in danger of, right off the bat, I can't think of one. But where there would be a great possibility of permanent type injury or even death, this type of situation. Since this will be this will carry a stiffer punishment than unlawful imprisonment in the first degree, then we almost have to go to the first degree. Now, I don't know how we can change that. That shouldn't change, though. Now, that was a policy judgment, too. I don't know if everyone on the committee agrees that it would be, that it should be made. But I felt that even though it's a parent or relative, that shouldn't, the fact that they have a defense under Section 4 shouldn't really give them license to endanger a child to that extent. You know, serious bodily injury. And for that reason, I removed the defense when we have Section 5. And it would make them just as liable under the Section 6 to expose a child to serious bodily injury. When we have the same time we think of serious bodily injury was defined, and this risk of safety would be nature of health clearly the carrier was more so to sell that. Or do you think we could still almost have the same time?
Well, you could, and then you also make me wonder too if you could conceivably have a conflict here with kidnapping, where you seize a person. And then you drive like a demon through heavy traffic or in flight, which suggests the victim to.
Well, judge,
this is serious bodily injury.
There's not a distinction there. The person, there's no removal for this, not necessarily removal from the place where he's bound.
Well, you say he restrains him. Well,
restraining him in the place where he's bound would be covered by this.
But if you look back to the definition of restrain, and it includes moving or holding him or confinement and so on.
The thing about death, though, now we're back to death again. Kidnapping will be a threat.
Well, that's right.
You've got to have either the secreting or threatened to use deadly physical force. Now, driving him at breakneck speed through town wouldn't really be threatening or using threatening to use deadly physical force. So, should bring us. I would think we have lawful imprisonment in the first degree. Now, I don't know if we're going to have, in our code, what we're going to have. I don't know if you have any conflict in this thing, but the other
Well, this is where you run into problems, is that we get lots of cases, or a number of them, where it's claimed, well, the district attorney has an unbridled discretion as to whether he charges the person with a misdemeanor or a felony. The language of the statutes will permit that either charge. And so he has an unbridled choice of making this distinction. And so he can take one person who's his friend and charge him with a misdemeanor, and if he doesn't like the other guy, charge him with a felony.
For instance, in the case of a contributor.
Right. There's we've had a number of these cases. And
the Perky type case.
The Perky type case, right.
And the court has been held that that is unlawful. Being ambiguous.
Well, and just in the Perky case.
Just in one case.
Just in Perky case, State versus Perky was the one where the court found that there was an unbridled discretion on the part of the district attorney or the grand jury to charge a felony or a misdemeanor without any reasonable guidelines.
I see. Now, is that contributing to?
No. It was a
check case.
Check case. Mm-hmm. And actually, that particular statute itself said the magistrate or district attorney may.
I see.
Yeah.
The statute itself provided. So.
Yeah, the court held the statute was unconstitutional. It violated equal protection of the law. And there have been a number of cases since then.
Which has never applied the same rule.
Right, because the court has looked at two separate statutes and said, well, even though the same conduct could violate both of these sections, there are reasonable guidelines in the statutes to differentiate between the two. And as long as there are reasonable guidelines, then it isn't a violation of due process.
Let me comment also that I would guess that the unlawful imprisonment in the second degree in particular would be at least a rather serious policy question. Because you can have a situation where in conjunction with the shoplifting statute, the manager or functionary, whoever it may be, of a store, holds somebody because he thinks they've shoplifted, which happens. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the person did not shoplift. And is this then going to be a crime for the person doing it?
It shouldn't be, because then we go back to the restraint. With knowledge that the restriction is unlawful, it's got to be what he thinks. If he thinks the person is guilty of shoplifting and can hold him under then there shouldn't be any question. If he knew that the person didn't shoplift and then held him, then he'd clearly come under.
Well, if he's just suspicious, though. And it may be that this is good policy. I don't know. But I can visualize that a section like this would create quite a little furor amongst the business people.
Well, under 154.392, they've got reasonable cause of the defense for an action of false arrest, since it's in the shoplifting case. A peace officer, merchant, or merchant's employee who has reasonable cause for believing that a person has committed the crime of shoplifting may detain and interrogate such person in regard thereto in a reasonable manner for a reasonable crime. And when he so does, and such person thereafter brings against a peace officer, merchant, or merchant's employee civil or criminal action for slander, false arrest, false imprisonment, assault, battery, or wrongful detention based upon the detention and interrogation, such reasonable cause shall be a defense to the action if the detention and interrogation were done in a reasonable manner and for a reasonable time. Now, I wouldn't think that we had, you know, that this would touch either of these statutes. I mean, it was my intention anyway that it wouldn't, that these would stay right, that they would stay as such, and that it would be a defense if they had reasonable cause. Now, I don't know my policy would be the fact that if you didn't have reasonable cause, you don't have any reason for doing it. I mean, just
seems to me that one question that we ought to consider is what kind of a test are we thinking of with respect to the knowledge? Now, is this going to be a subjective test as far as this defendant is concerned? Because now this shoplifting provision, that's an objective sort of test, the way that's worded. I mean, reasonable, when they're talking about reasonable cause to believe, that's an objective test rather than a... I mean, we're talking in terms here of an actual knowledge, at least that's what the implication of language is, that, and without saying it's good or bad, I think that we should recognize there is a distinction there, and from the standpoint of a prosecutor, too, in a case like this, this means that he's going to have to prove or come forward with some evidence tending to show that this defendant knew that what he was doing was unlawful. That's another policy question we've got to consider, whether...
That's the problem throughout the whole section.
Yeah, whether or not...
That's exactly what I had in mind a while ago.
Is this, for the purposes of defining restraint, does this then place too great a burden on the state to actually prove that the defendant knew that this was unlawful? Or should it be maybe in terms of an exception? In other words, unless the defendant or unless the person knew or had reason to know that the restriction was lawful or something. In other words, just flip it over and state it positively rather than negatively. But this just
you may have a problem in using the word. The definition for the word restraint, as it applies to kidnapping, and then take it over here and apply it to, for instance, unlawful imprisonment or custody. In the kidnapping case, there probably be no problem in proving that the person knew that the restraint was unlawful. In this other type of case, restraint.
Pretty close.
It might be pretty close.
A lot of cases might not be so limiting in the fact that because one person would be able to prove that person what their purpose in restraining them was. And I mean, I would think it's cut and dry that you don't restrain a person unless you have some reason for doing it. And your reason would be so limited in the situation of an adult for restraining another adult other than his safety or his health, or unless you had lawful authority. But I would think it would be harder for you to prove that you lawfully thought you could do it, then it would ever be for the state to show you do it, wouldn't it? Because in what situation can you restrain an adult?
Well, of course, the burden's on the state to prove it. It isn't up to the defendant to disprove.
No, but I meant that, you know, from the defendant's point of view, the case should be pretty slim in what he would have actually, you know, had thought that he had a lawful authority to do it when he really didn't.
Well, it would be the person that gets restrained, as I say, this is the thing that seems like a policy question that has to be pretty carefully considered, is that the person who gets restrained by a storm or some period of time is irate and he's mad and he goes to the prosecutor and I want to fight.